Populations, sex, and we know where all those babies come from, but how?
Oh, my love is like a red, red rose that's newly sprung in June. Oh, my love is like the melody that's sweetly played in tune. As fair art thou, my bonnie lass, so deep in love am I.
But that red, red rose also has a smell. How significant is that? Last week on The Science Show on RN, we foreshadowed the pheromone party about to erupt on Catalyst next Thursday. We introduced Professor Manfred Milinski from the Max Planck Institute in Germany, who showed how we are so sensitive to chemicals that indicate a potential lover's immune system. Here's more.
Maybe we have evolved these preferences for perfume ingredients over the thousands of years that perfumes are used in all cultures in the world. And we tested for that with our volunteers in Bern and looked whether students who share the same immune gene share the same preference of natural perfume ingredients. And if you add those findings up, then we can really conclude from our results that perfumes are selected so that they amplify the natural perfume message that you produce yourself.
I always thought that perfumes were a trivial thing.
Yeah, I thought so too. But if you imagine they are and have been extremely expensive and the best selling areas in the big shops are filled with perfumes and people spend a lot of money to smell the way they like to smell, then it might not be that trivial. You really care how you smell. Because we assume, and I think we have shown it, that the perfume has to fit exactly your individual collection of immunogenes. And you got 8 of 1,000. So that means that if you found a perfume that has ingredients that exactly mimic your personal signal, then this is a rare perfume. Maybe about 100 mixtures that are on the market approach all these individual mixtures to a certain extent. I think they will never signal the whole range of genes. It needs the original animal-derived substance or flower-derived substance. If you imagine that rose oil, the Absolue, contains about 300 different, qualitatively different ingredients, and only 3 of them produce the subjective odor of rose, then the other 297 ingredients have a different message. And I think it's one of them that by chance mimics one of your and my version of immune odor that we produce. And our predecessors found out if they use that stuff on themselves, it smells good. Maybe that was the way they selected it.
So that rose, that red, red rose, has 300 different chemical ingredients to its smell. Dr. Manfred Milinski from the Max Planck Institute with Dr. Jonica Newby, who presents the pheromone party on Catalyst on ABC One next Thursday evening. And another guest is Professor Rob Brooks from the University of New South Wales, who has the highest regard for Professor Milinski and who thinks constantly about sex.
Robson, what's your job?
Well, my job is to think about sex. I think about sex in the animal world, including in the human world, and the consequences that it has for the lives that individuals lead.
So, Professor, are you looking forward to seeing a whole lot of 20-somethings play the mating game?
I think it's going to be fascinating.
So am I. I actually think this is our most intriguing animal behaviour experiment yet.
Well, what animal could be more complicated than humans? Yeah. And what behaviour could be more complicated than mating behaviour?
Well, attraction itself, what does that mean to you?
Well, the important thing about evolution is that it's really all about reproduction. You and me and everybody in the audience comes from a long line of success stories, because every generation you come from a woman and a man who managed to find each other, possibly fall in love if they were lucky, but certainly have sex at least once and raise at least one offspring. And that goes back thousands and thousands of generations. So the difference between those ancestors and the other people who lived at the same time but never managed to do that is really the difference that has shaped us in evolutionary terms.
Yeah, because we tend to think that attraction is trivial.
Yeah, and it's anything other than trivial. It's complicated and it's very, very hard to pin down. But when you're close to somebody and that chemistry comes through, you really know about it, and it's very, very powerful.
So when it comes to attraction as an evolutionary biologist, what are the most important things?
Wow, there's such a long list of possible things that can influence attraction. And sometimes we don't even notice them because people who don't have those things don't even come onto our radars. But for women, how tall a man is, how smart he is, how funny he is, how kind he is, are all important. Then it boils down to more idiosyncratic things about, you know, what he believes and his approach to life and stuff. And those are often more compatibility issues than basic attraction issues. For men, usually it's about youth still, unfortunately. Younger women get more attention than older women. And that's probably because younger women have a bigger net of men who are attracted to them. There are body shape preferences that men have, and many of those body shape preferences are quite strong, but they're not nearly as uniform as you might have been led to believe, because all of these attraction studies study average preferences. And so we might say the average waist to hip ratio of 0.7 is very attractive. There are lots of men who are attracted to women of a fuller figure, and there are lots of men who are attracted to women who are perhaps less rounded. And so here we're talking about averages, but the important thing is that you end up with an individual.
It was interesting, you mentioned perhaps a lot more looks things with the guys. And someone said to me the other day, I thought looks didn't matter as much to women. And I just went, who gave you that idea? We're just much nicer about it.
Oh, absolutely. I think, but I think that also, and this is a controversial thing to say, but I think that both men and women are kind of hung up on women's looks. I think looks are not only a way in which women attract men, they're also a way in which they compete with other women.
Well, so much you kind of know, but the point about sex, as Manfred Milinski pointed out last week, is that it's a really messy way to reproduce, and we do it only to stay one step ahead of the plague. We sort our immune genes that way. Rob Brooks also points out that if you think about it, sex is really unlikely.
The job of chemistry, the adapted job for which it has evolved, is not to keep people together until they're old and grey and can appear in some kind of, you know, pensioner commercial or something like that. The job of chemistry is to get them together in the first place, because it's kind of a bizarre thing. You imagine two individual mammals who have very little in common, who don't have the same interests, come together and combine their DNA to make a unique new individual. It means you have to suppress all sorts of instincts of, you know, yuck instincts to do with bodily fluids, for instance. And how do you do that other than to have some special adaptation that kind of fools you that this is a good idea?
So you think it's a bad idea?
Oh, it can be a terrible idea sometimes.
But yeah, I guess when you look at it logically, it is pretty weird. We are quite self-contained creatures. We do have revulsion to bodily functions. And yet this thing called chemistry happens and all that goes out the window.
Absolutely. I mean, for two people to sit close together on a couch and talk about something, it takes a certain effort of will. You have to break down personal space issues. For two people to lie together in the same bed or to touch each other, that takes a tremendous amount of suppression of all of our safety instincts. And in order to do that, we have to have attraction and we have to have all sorts of reward pathways, and our hormones provide that for us.
And the difference between chemistry then and long-term relationships?
Well, we have a whole lot of biology involved in attraction, and then we have another bunch of biology involved in keeping us together. And that's not just biology, of course, that's social processes and that's expectations, etc., etc. Now, two individuals don't have to stay together forever in order to raise a child. So what evolution has done is it has equipped us to be able to stay together long enough to raise a child and to raise a child for what that child needs. In the Amazon, where the food falls from trees and it's all very easy to live, marriages don't last very long. They last about 3 years. But the Inuit in Greenland they have to stay together for life, basically. They mate for life and they pair for life because it's incredibly hard and you have to work full on all day, every day, in order to just raise one or two children. And marriages tend to last much longer. And so our adaptations that underpin the ability to form relationships and to stay together are very much sensitive to our environment and sensitive to how hard it is to bring up kids.
Rob Brooks, and one of the many real discoveries presented in Catalyst next week, is copulin. Ever heard of copulin? Well, its name suggests what it is and does.
Copulins are a fascinating subject because this is something that's been shown to work in rhesus monkeys and in other primates. And, you know, we're very much primates. We only 5 million years ago diverged from our common ancestor with the chimps and bonobos. So anything that works in other primates, it's worth giving it a try on humans.
So do you reckon you'll follow this up? I mean, what did you think of the experiment today?
I love the experiment today. I thought it was very, very interesting. I think that this idea of men being more generous in their ratings is a surprising idea, in that they become essentially less critical and less judgmental of women's looks. But I think it's worth following up. There's all sorts of other things. I mean, I'd love to take copulins to a speed dating event. I don't think we'd ever get ethics permission to do it. But see what happens when the copulins are present and when they aren't, and whether that changes the rate of people hooking up.
I mean, I've never heard of them, copulins. People even, had you?
No, this is brand new science. It's something that's very exciting and very new.
And yet, when I heard about it, I thought it makes sense to me that that would exist, particularly with my veterinary background and having watched animals come into season.
You know, that's the funny thing about people. They're slightly strange mammals, purely because they don't come into season or they don't appear to come into season. What I think is happening now, we thought that people suppressed the coming into season, suppressed that estrus, but I think what's happened is we've actually smeared that estrus out across the whole monthly cycle. So in effect, women are mimicking being ready to mate at any time. And that's consistent with our mating behaviour, of course, because people can have sex at any time in the cycle.
But it's more than that, because it is starting to become clear, isn't it, from science, that at ovulation time, women are different.
There are a lot of reports of women behaving differently. Last year in the American election, actually, there was even reports that women who were ovulating would respond better to Barack Obama. But if they happened on voting day to be at the opposite end of their cycle, in the luteal phase of their cycle, they were more likely to vote for Mitt Romney.
This was an actual study?
It was an actual study, and it was published just before the election. In fact, CNN had to take their news story down because they got howled down because of the idea. Of course, this is ancient history, this long history of women being seen as fickle and their opinions being driven by their hormonal cycles, and this fed into this prejudice that something as important as an election might hinge on whether women were ovulating or not on that given day, where, of course, there were far more substantive issues to compare the candidates on. And so, yeah, it was very controversial research. There seem to be a substantial number of studies now that show women are more interested in sex, more interested in sex with somebody other than their partner. They tend to have stronger preferences for more masculinized men. They go for bad boys at that time of the month. There are also studies that show that on the contraceptive pill, that effect of ovulation is really dulled out. And in fact, there are some reports now, and these are more anecdotal reports than scientific evidence, that when women come off the pill, suddenly the guy that they're with doesn't look as attractive as he looked when she was on the pill. So there's no doubt at all that hormones affect behavior. There's no doubt that hormones affect how people respond to their partners and their sexual behavior. How strong those effects are and how strong they are relative to all the other things that are going on in our daily life, that's something that we need to tease apart now.
Yeah, because I wonder if we overrate the importance of looks.
I think we substantially overrate it. And I think the reason that we overrate it is looks are a great way to sell products. Looks are a great way to promote ourselves. The ideal female face has a very small lower face, including a small chin and then large full lips. And we know that across the monthly cycle, that face changes. And in fact, women's faces tend closer towards the ideal when they're at that most fertile peak. And they tend to go away from that ideal when they're in the luteal phase, when they aren't fertile.
Well, this is very new research, isn't it?
This is absolutely, and this is from the same group that gave us the copulin research. They're looking at is the human estrus concealed or not? Because that's been a huge debate in anthropology ever since Darwin. Why don't humans have sexual swellings on their butts? And why don't they run around like dogs and bitches on heat, mating at only a certain time, and then, you know, completely forget about sex? Imagine if humans could forget about sex for 9 days out of every 10 or 35 days out of every 40. Imagine how different human society would be if women were only sexually receptive for 2 or 3 days every 6 months. Now, some married couples might feel like that's a normal situation, but humans are capable of having sex right across the cycle. And what we think has happened is that the receptive period has gone from being a very constricted period to a much longer period in chimps and bonobos, and in humans it's almost right across the cycle.
So were you surprised by the face change during the cycle research?
No, I wasn't especially surprised by that, because behavior we know changes across the cycle. It was a very interesting study that got the Ig Nobel Prize for research that makes you laugh and then makes you think, a couple of years back now, where one of the graduate students worked as a bouncer at a strip club, and he got the strippers to track their cycles. And the strippers who were on the pill earned a very similar amount every shift. The strippers who weren't on the pill earned much, much more when they were at the fertile peak than when they were not sexually receptive. And so that suggests that there is something that men are queuing in on. What it was, they couldn't tell with that particular study. And there are now at least a dozen studies of that type that show that our ovulation isn't nearly as concealed as we think it is.
Okay, so what is the classic? We asked what the classic female face is. What is the classic testosterone male face?
The testosteronized male face has a big jaw, the big classic square jaw. And you often see cartoons of highly masculinized men will have this incredible jaw, woodcutter's jaw. That's the first thing and the most important thing. The other thing is we have signals to emphasize testosterone, and that's facial hair. Facial hair is there to very much emphasize the shape of the face and possibly in some cases conceal it. But you can't grow a beard unless you're a real man.
And you've found, or it has recently been found, some fascinating differences in preferences for testosteronized faces between different countries.
Yes, so if you show women, and the internet's wonderful for these kinds of experiments, but if you show women a bunch of male faces and you get them to rate exactly the same faces, women from different countries have slightly different preferences, often sometimes even quite dramatically different preferences, from a very strong preference for highly testosteronized faces to a much weaker preference for testosterone to an even a preference for more feminized faces. And we think that that's got a lot to do with the essential dilemma of choosing a man, which is, do I choose a man who's got great genes and who's great at competing with other men and who's going to really thrive and provide? Or do I choose a man who's going to be a nice guy and I'm going to be able to get along with him and he's going to be a good dad? And good dads are much easier to get along with, tend to be men with more feminized faces.
Yeah, see, I found that a fascinating thing watching over the years various friends pair up for their long-term mate choices. And it seems that every woman finds herself choosing somewhere along the spectrum of testosterone or male enough to float the boat, have some chemistry, but not so much that they feel unsafe.
The bad boy, he can be incredibly attractive. And yet at the same time, are you safe with the bad boy? If he's bad with other people, is he going to be bad with me? Is he going to mature? I mean, the ideal thing is to get men to mature, to cure them somehow, into great dads and great partners. But, you know, does a leopard change his spots? There's a little bit of evidence that he does, because nearly all men, once they settle down, once they become fathers, their testosterone tends to go down. And so that's probably them settling into fatherhood, becoming a good dad, not being as keen on the argy-bargy that settles the business of who gets to mate.
Do you find yourself as an evolutionary biologist interested in this kind of choice that women have to make along this spectrum?
Absolutely. I mean, it's quite a delectable tension, isn't it, between the safe guy who's nice but might not perhaps get all the blood rushing and the bad boy who's all very rock and roll. And I think that, you know, that's an exquisite dilemma. And women really have to find their own way through that dilemma. For guys, really, you've just got to play the hand that's dealt you. You can't fake it. You can't pretend to be a badder boy than you really are, because you will be found out and you will be punished.
Just in a nutshell, what difference between countries did you find?
Growing economies where there is a lot of inequality, and particularly where healthcare is bad, tend to have much stronger emphasis on masculinity in those countries, and women tend to prefer men who are more masculine. So places like the Russian Federation, Brazil, Argentina, Mexico, where there's still plenty of violence, there's still plenty of inequality that fuels that violence, that's where testosterone-heavy men are at a premium. Whereas places like Australia and Western Europe, where things are a little bit safer, we tend to go more for a metrosexualized male.
Really? So, in fact, the Australian ideal man for a woman is a bit more metrosexual than we'd like.
We're going to get a lot of women writing in after the show and saying, that's not me, I don't recognise myself. But on average, absolutely, yes.
Rob Brooks is Professor of Sex at the University of New South Wales, and Jonica Newby presents The Great Pheromone Party on Catalyst next Thursday at 8 p.m. on ABC One. Take your T-shirt and sniff. If you prefer your science more stark, do watch SBS Television for Michael Mosley's new series, Pain, Pus and Poison, starting Monday at 8:30, SBS One. Next week, The Science Show presents two remarkable women talking about jellyfish and cyber plague. The Science Show is produced by David Fisher and Charlie McCune. I'm Robin Williams.
Though it were 10,000 miles, my love, though it were 10,000 miles, and I will come again.